This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, and it's our week in review, a busy week of protests over race, racism, police violence against people of color, from Minneapolis to Washington, and here in Boston, Brockton, and around New England.
Several hundred demonstrators are marching up to the Capitol building from Boston Common.
I am exhausted. As your elected district attorney, we have looked around this country and seen police officers shoot us in the street as if we were animals.
Because that's not the people who run stuff.
The police have moved forward on the protesters, shooting gas canisters. Protesters have been throwing fireworks at the cops and bottles. It's getting a little tense in downtown Brockton.
If a city or a state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them.
As Americans take to the streets in the midst of a global pandemic and economic strain, where are we on policing, race, and equality? That's the question on the table this week. Join the conversation. Share your thoughts. Where do we go from here as a city, commonwealth, nation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So joining us now are our Week in Review panelists. First, we have Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, also former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Welcome back, Michael.
Glad to be here.
Also joining us is Howard Bryant. He's a senior writer for ESPN, a sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, and author of 9 books, including Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field. Howard, welcome to Week in Review.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
And Tom Nichols, he's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School, and a senior advisor to the Lincoln Project. Tom, welcome back to you, too.
Thanks. Good to be back.
So, Michael Curry, I want to start with you. One of the things we've done over the last week is had voices, people on, and then brought them back because things are changing so quickly. You were on with us last Friday, 7 days later. Where would you say we are in America compared to when we last talked?
Yeah, I'm always thinking about Dr. King's question to us that's still relevant today. Where do we go from here, chaos or community? If you had asked me a week ago whether I thought this was a moment or a movement, I probably would have answered that question differently. But I do think now this is a movement. I think it's sustained. I think there are enough voices, diverse voices coming to the table. I just got off a call with Mayor Walsh and business leaders who are thinking differently about this than any way I've ever heard before. So I think this could potentially be a movement, and I'm hoping that that's the case.
Howard, how about you? Protests this week here in Boston, Brockton, elsewhere, they were mostly peaceful. Looking back on the long stretch that was this week in America, how would you assess where we are in Massachusetts right now?
Well, living out here in Northampton and the fact that it's a 96 or 97% white town, and there were 1,500 kids out there surrounding the police station a few days ago. I would agree that this is a movement. I'm always very skeptical of calling them movements because of the speed in which things change. But at the same time, I can't argue the fact that this is the number of people and the type of people that have been out and the response is unprecedented for me so far.
Tom Nichols, everything that's happening this week is happening against the backdrop of what's been unfolding in Washington, which sets a tone. We're going to dive into the president, his actions further a little later on. But for now, do you think there's any direct impact on us here in New England this week?
Well, of course, I just have to point out I don't represent the War College or the Lincoln Project or anybody else. I think that, you know, I'm actually hopeful as well. like everybody else, because I think that it's been interesting to see that the epicenter really has been in Washington, D.C., at least in terms of the political narrative, and, you know, how the protesters in D.C. are going to face off against the president of the United States. And I don't think that actually has rippled far away. I think New York in particular is always a different case because it's New York, because of the urban geography, because of, you know, the concentration of people. But I think it's been it's almost been heartening to see that that New England and other regions have not been drawn into that kind of direct confrontation with between the White House and the protesters in Washington. And I actually think the protesters in Washington have done a pretty good job up till now.
Michael Curry, one of the things that I think about all the time right now, especially these last couple of days, is how much should our focus be on what the president is doing, what's happening in Washington, versus on what's happening right here in JP and Roslindale and Nubian Square and at the State House?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny. I don't think we have the luxury of only focusing on one thing. We can pay attention to what this president does and does not do. And quite frankly, there's enough to pay attention to there. His actions with the protesters outside of the White House was disturbing. And I think we're seeing the backlash from military leaders who have been, quite frankly, complicit with their silence and are now starting to come out. But we also got to pay attention to what the protests mean. And I would argue what the violence means. I've been a big proponent of us being students of history, that violence has produced change. I would argue, you know, the Civil War was violent and produced an end to slavery. And I'm not saying that I condone that, but I'm saying we need to pay attention. People are now paying attention in ways that we never have, and that we've ignored the cries, the frustration, the anger of populations of people in this country who've been abused, neglected, mistreated, and it boiled over. So now we have a moment to decide whether we're going to be responsive, and we do need attention to this president, because he fans the flames on a regular basis when he tells governors, why don't you, you know, put the hammer down on these communities. We know what that means.
Howard, here's President Trump early. Oh, go ahead. Who was going to jump in there? Is that you, Tom?
Oh, that was me. It's Howard. I was just going to say, and I agree, but I agree that violence does create change. And I would look at it, I would sort of spin it around, and I would say the level of violence that the president seems to be willing to inflict on these communities, on the protesters, is exactly creating the change. You cannot take people who believe that they live in a free country, especially a lot of these overwhelmingly white kids you see out there protesting. They believe they are free. And the more you put the hammer down on them, the more they come out. I mean, this is not something where they're trying to strive for equality. They believe in their freedom. And so I think that as we focus on the violence, whenever we talk about violence, we're always talking about it from a protest standpoint. I'm actually looking at it from the violence I see from police in Philadelphia, Buffalo, D.C., Minneapolis, shooting rubber bullets onto the front porches of American citizens. That is the level of violence. That's the type of violence that's actually going to create change, because people aren't going to stand for that.
And if I could add to that, I think it's critical there, is 1963, the Children's Crusade, the children who marched on downtown Birmingham, Dr. King and others knew what they were doing when they knew Bull Connor would put the dogs and the hoses on them. They knew that the officers in Selma would beat them. And to his point, it woke up the consciousness of the nation. And I think this is what the president's actions, what we're seeing with George Floyd, it's waking up the consciousness of a nation to say, this might be when we need to act.
Let's take a couple of calls here. I want to put a couple together. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Nancy on the line from Framingham. Nancy, go ahead.
Yes, as one who came of age during the 60s, I do remember all of those turbulent times. I want to say that I went off to college the day after Birmingham, the day after the church bombing. It was that significant. And today, I think what we need in this country is a complete cleansing, a regime set change in Congress, in the White House, in the Supreme Court, in the sense that according to the Constitution and according to the laws, all American citizens are equal under those two the Constitution and the laws, and not all citizens are treated equal. And unless we strive for that and achieve that, we're not the people that we think we are.
Nancy, thank you for that call. And you talked about going off to college during that time. We've got Nate on the line from Middleboro. Nate, I think you're just off of college, right?
Hi. Yeah, I recently graduated from college, and I was studying photography there. And I've been working the past 2 years photographing activism in Boston and trying my hardest to create a platform for causes that I care about. But something that I've struggled with and observed a lot is that activism, especially in the age of quick, big movements on social media, it doesn't really extend beyond the 24-hour or the weekly news cycle. So what can people my age do to sustain activism beyond this weekly cycle and really, you know, encourage systemic changes beyond just committees or commissions?
Nate, thanks for that call, too. So I'm going to take those in order. Tom Nichols, I'm going to start with you. You were very clear that you don't speak for the Lincoln Project, but you are a part of it. And that
yes.
is, in fact, partly set up to create change at the federal level and who holds elected office. What's your response to that, likening to the need for big change in the 1960s?
There's two things I would say immediately. First, to the young man who just graduated from college, what you can do to sustain change is vote. Because this is a generation, particularly as is always the case, of people under 30 have the worst record for showing up to vote. If you really want to sustain change, then you're going to have to get together with a lot of other people your age and get them out to vote, because their voting numbers are still terrible. They're still one of the least likely to vote. So that's the first thing I'd say. The other is that we have to stop comparing everything to the 1960s, because I think that's dangerous. And I think in this particular confrontation, I agree completely that the violence, the rubber bullets, the violence that the government is willing to inflict will actually change more minds than the violence on the part of the protesters. And I think the key mistake, and one that I was very worried would be made early on, was that the protesters would escalate the violence. This is in the history, just to put a historical context on it, in the history of confrontations between governments and protesters everywhere, each side will have elements that try to draw the foul to see if they can provoke the other into the overreaction that then brings people to their side. I would argue that right now, the Trump administration in particular is trying very hard to get the protesters to draw that foul, and I think they're mostly resisting that. But, you know, setting troops loose on looters and setting troops loose on little girls is not the same dynamic, and I think that has to be a real issue of concern, because it's very clear, especially after the last 2 days, that the administration, in my view, is eager to have that kind of confrontation. And I think it could be disastrous and undo progress. I agree with both of my fellow panelists here. I think there's a remarkable amount of comedy and agreement across races and classes and regions.
Just to be clear, Tom, when
so
you
clear.
Say comedy, you mean C-O-M-I-T-Y.
Sorry.
Just helping everyone be clear. All right. And let's get Michael and Howard in there to react to what that. Yeah. Let's get Michael and Howard in there to react to that. And to answer Nate's question, the caller who said, okay, how do we sustain social action now?
Michael, you
want to
take it?
Yeah, I'll jump in first. You know, it's funny. I love, and I think it was Nancy, the caller, says, we're not the people we think we are. I think that's been the issue for us as a country. That's why people take a knee. As we profess all these ideals, people want to be false patriots and celebrate the flag and show up for Patriots Day, but then they don't live the ideals. They don't support the ideals. It is very American to take a knee. It is very American to challenge us to live up to those ideals when we're not doing it. And you can have a knee on your neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And I hope the listeners sat and stood still for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. By 3 minutes, I was saying to myself, that's murder.
Yeah.
Five minutes, I was saying everyone has to feel that's murder. And to Nate, you know, first, congratulations. You're graduating in the most difficult year that we've known of, you know, with this pandemic. So congratulations to you. I would say, you know, one, I've been telling people, be a student of history first, being conscious. Read New Jim Crow, read the Blood of Emmett Till, read The Miseducation of a Negro, do the homework. and then show up. So yes, vote, absolutely, you need to vote. You can show up to city council hearings, legislative hearings, the congressional hearings, you need to write letters. Activism is not foreign to us, but not enough people exercise that right and that tool.
So yeah. Howard, Michael just made a comment. He talked about the knee and the knee, this sounds glib, I don't mean it to at all. We are having a moment of the knee, not only the awfulness of the knee on George Floyd's neck, but a revisiting of what was a controversy around Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, which is now actually being used by some law enforcement officers around the country as a sign of solidarity. Can you begin to make some sense of that for us?
Well, I think you try to look at what it means, and you hope that what it means is that over the last 4 years, there's been growth. I'm not sure I believe it, because in so many different instances, you see the very same cops taking a knee 10 minutes or 20 minutes later, beating up the kids that they're taking a knee with. So I'm trying not to think that all of these symbolisms actually mean something. But I think it is some form of a start. And I think there is some form of communication that is taking place that is required in order to move any level forward. I think that to the caller graduating, and I agree with Tom as well about voting. I don't want to overestimate voting, though. I think voting in a lot of ways is overrated. There's a great piece in the Baffler this week about all the different things that we need to do on top of voting, and that I think there's a great line in that piece that says, you can't vote out things that aren't on the ballot. And absolutely, you've got to get out there and you've got to put your name on, you know, on this country and on policy by voting. But at the same time, you got to stay on target. And one of the things that has me concerned about this is, are we staying on target? The target is the police. The target is absolutely the type of reforms that need to be made so they don't do this, so they're not killing people. To be really quick on Colin Kaepernick, there's no question in my mind that what he did 4 years ago is exposing a lot of people in the corporate world right now, because now we're going to see, what do these statements actually mean? Not just for him not having a job, but okay, what are you going to do with all of these companies saying they stand in solidarity with Black lives and with justice and everything else? But if you notice, those statements do not necessarily directly discuss police. And if you don't do that, then I'm really wondering what they're actually doing.
So we're going to take a break. And as we do, I want to go out on a little bit of sound, and then we'll take a break after that. This Patriots cornerback Stephen Gilmore joined a series of NFL stars yesterday in a video calling for the league to condemn racism and admit it was wrong and silencing players for peacefully protesting during past seasons. This is a moment where you have employees isn't the right word, but you do have, to some extent, employees calling out their employer for some egregious behavior over the last few years and beginning to publicly hold that employer to task. I don't think that's a stretch. Here's a sample of that video.
How many times do we need to ask you to listen to your players?
What will it take
for one of us to be murdered by police brutality?
What if I was George Floyd?
If I was George Floyd?
What if I was George Floyd?
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 I am George Floyd.
I am Breonna Taylor.
I am Ahmaud Arbery.
I am Eric Garner.
I am McCormick Dunn.
I am Tamir Rice.
I am Trayvon Martin.
I am Walter Scott.
I am Michael Brown Jr.
I am Samuel Du Bois.
I am Frank Smart.
I'm Philip White.
I am Jordan Baker.
We will not be silenced.
We assert our right to peacefully protest.
It shouldn't take this long to admit.
We're talking about race, policing, brutality in America, and where we are this week and going forward in Boston, the Commonwealth, and beyond. With us this hour are Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board, Howard Bryant, author and senior writer for ESPN, and Tom Nichols. He's a professor of national security affairs. And you're with us. Pull up a chair to the table. Join the conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Just before the break, we heard some sound of NFL players, including one of the New England Patriots, talking to owners and to the NFL about what it's going to take to begin to take action. We've heard similar things from Facebook employees this week, a couple who stepped down and some calling out of Facebook for its response to misinformation and the president. We've talked about so many dimensions to this, and it brings me back to Michael saying at the beginning of this hour, I didn't think maybe we were in a movement a week ago. I think we are now. So where does that need to go? Michael, maybe I'll bring your voice back in here.
Yeah, and I know I do this often, but I have to ground us in history. You know, I think of Tommy Smith and John Carlos in October 1963 that threw their black fists in the air with the gloves at the Olympics. I think of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I think of Jim Brown. I think of black activists, actors, and leaders who took risks and knew that it, like Muhammad Ali, caused them their careers, might cause them their wealth to make a statement and stand up. That's what you saw in that video by these athletes today. They knew, Dwayne Wade, LeBron James knows that every time they make a statement, they could be losing conservative voters, Republican voters, and they did it anyway. We've been waiting for that kind of courage and that kind of risk from our black athletes and actors and athletes of white actors and athletes for a long time. And who am I to say, give up millions of dollars? But I'm proud that they did that.
Yeah, I was going to say,
Howard, Tom, yeah.
I'm just going to say, it's, you know, 1968's a big deal. And that is, these are the things that people do remember. Mexico City, no question. And today is John Carlos's 75th birthday. So Michael, good looking out on that, right? So it is, you know, I look at it this way. I really do feel that, I think some ways this is a delayed reaction. If you were 18 years old in 2008, and we remember Grant Park, you remember this idea that we had turned a corner, and now you're 30 years old and you've seen things go backwards for the last 3.5 years to that day, you're angry and you feel betrayed. And this is why I believe that this is a movement that people are saying, this is not what it was supposed to be, that you are dealing with this generation of adults now who are coming into their own. They're probably, you know, when you turn 30, you know, you're getting married, you're having kids, you're starting to build your career and all of those things. And you're feeling that this is not what it was supposed to be back in 2008. And I think that's one of the reasons you see people out there, that they really, really care about this. But I agree with Michael as well, that I think that you need those leaders and you need people out there who say what you think, and that they can actually be willing to sort of represent you in a way that we really hadn't seen before.
Tom Nichols, I want to talk about leadership for a minute. Bear with me. I'm going to give you two pieces of sound here and then bring a question to you. First, giving his regular update on coronavirus Monday, Governor Charlie Baker spoke about the protests, equality in America, but he focused on the leader of his own party, President Trump, and what President Trump had said to governors on Monday around the country needing to dominate the streets. Here he is.
I know I should be surprised when I hear incendiary words like this from him, but I'm not. At so many times during these past several weeks, when the country needed compassion and leadership the most, it was simply nowhere to be found. Instead, we got bitterness, combativeness, and self-interest. That's not what we need in Boston. It's not what we need right now in Massachusetts. And it's definitely not what we need across this great country of ours either.
And you could hear the emotion there. Then on Wednesday, we wanted a perspective from law enforcement here on Radio Boston. We spoke with Suffolk County Sheriff Stephen Tompkins. He is a law enforcement officer, also African-American. I want to play you a little bit of what he told us. Here it is.
Black Americans want to be loved as much as we love this country. We feel ownership and pride in this country, but then we get the short end of the stick. All that we've built to help build up this country, others have profited from that, and we haven't. And to think that that is going to be okay, well, it's not okay.
Tom, these are leadership voices. What was remarkable about Charlie Baker is that he rarely does call out the president, let alone as emotionally or as strongly as he did there. And Sheriff Tompkins just speaking very, very truthfully, even, you know, wearing his official role as a law enforcement officer, I don't mean to express surprise, just noting the honesty of that. Are we demanding something different from leaders? And are we seeing a misalignment in who's willing to step up and do that and who isn't?
I think there's definitely a misalignment, and I'm hopeful but wary that the other night where the White House, whoever it was, because everybody's pointing fingers at each other now, whoever ordered firing pepper gas and rubber bullets into peaceful protesters in front of the White House so that the president could have a photo op, that could be an inflection point. And I think that if the question is, where do we go from here and what kind of leadership do we need? You know, the leadership now is devolving to governors and to members of Congress. But you brought up the Lincoln Project earlier, and this goes back to some of the earlier questions. I think that if there's a loss of focus, because moments like this create big, unwieldy coalitions that tend to come apart pretty easily. If there's a loss of focus about November and the president's reelected, conservative senators are brought back to the Senate, that's going to extinguish a lot of the potential progress here. And I think I worked on Beacon Hill. I worked in the Senate, as some of you know. And I always tell people, activism is energizing and it can get you very far, but in the end, policy is boring and it's got to get done. And I just worry that these moments run out of momentum and then fission in 100 different directions. Now, that's when leadership really becomes crucial. And I think that actually the protests have been fortunate that the president went AWOL at a key moment, because I think there was a kind of rally around the president moment starting to coalesce. And during the break, I saw that that NPR and Marist just dropped a poll where 50, and NPR obviously not, you know, and Marist not some kind of right-wing, you know, polling organization, 56% of registered voters believe that police are behaving appropriately or not aggressively enough, which shows you the fragility of the moment that you're in. And I,
so let's, really let me give thing. Yeah, I had not seen that poll. Howard, your reaction to that polling, that what we just heard from Tom and the cuts that I played for him.
Well, absolutely. And I think he's 100% right. I think the all of these moments are very fragile. That's when people say, well, you know, are we reaching this watershed moment? And I said, we need to wait and see. I mean, the world is moving so quickly. And when you look at how corporations react, I mean, they're dousing some of the incendiary stuff. But the real question is what is the lasting long-term effect on this? Policy is everything. I think one of the things that's really bothered me that I've been worried about, just as what Tom was saying earlier, but I was worried in a different respect, which is everything that we've been hearing for the last several days has been about abolishing racism. And I'm like, wait a minute, this feels like a misdirection to me. What we're really talking about is policy. You're talking about tangible steps to improve accountability on police. This is the end game. The end game is the actual shifting where you can get accountability. I really don't believe that people are out in the street. If government had come forward and arrested these guys, and that the public was willing to prosecute them, and that juries were willing to to jail them, and that you knew that the systems were going to work. And if you don't have that type of confidence, if you don't have that belief, if these types of things don't come out of this movement, then it's going to be another thing that we all talked about, but nothing physically changed. And one cool thing about this is that I notice that when it comes to criminality, when Black people are criminalized, it's very easy to come up with tangible, hardcore solutions. More cops on the street, more policy, longer sentences. But when it comes to something like this, the narrative has become, let's be kinder to each other. So policy is the target. Stay on target.
And if I could...
So I... Go ahead, Michael.
So I think one is, we know that we see America differently, right? It's a tale of two cities or a tale of two countries. We know that too many white citizens do not validate the lived experiences of African Americans and others, right? I have white men tell me all the time, it can't be as bad as you say, right? Because they've never been stopped by the police. They've never been, as a counselor, a royal in Boston told a story in a state house, they've never had an officer pull you over and put a gun in your face and then let you go. They've never had the humiliation of being African American and being denied a job you know that you were qualified for, and you just knew in your gut that they just did not want to hire a person of color, right? They've never had those lived experiences, so they can say, well, it's clearly not as bad. That's privilege. That's the whole benefit of white skin privilege, is that you can sit back and judge the experiences of others. So I say that to say, with the poll that came out, we knew that in the poll in 2019, that we see this country differently. The challenge is, we will never convince every American to deal with racism. And I probably maybe little disagree with the comment before, that I do think it's about changing hearts and minds. I want to change the middle, and I want us to change some of the fringe parts of the Republican Party that have just been resistant to this. And I know there's some many Republicans who see racism, not enough. But I also want to change the institutions, right? We want to change the achievement gap, the predatory practices that target communities of color and that got us in this housing crisis that disparately impacted people of color. I want to change the fact that Black and brown citizens have unequal treatment in our healthcare system, as the Institute of Medicine taught us over 20 years ago, that it wasn't just because we ate pork and we didn't eat right. It was because doctors treated us differently. That's why people are marching in the street. It's not just because of the knee. As Al Sharpton said in that speech at the service, it's because the knee on our neck represents all kinds of sectors where we've been denied opportunity, access, we've been disrespected, we've been locked out. And now you're seeing that play out in the anger, the frustration on our street corners.
Yeah. So just to be clear, that was Al Sharpton at George Floyd's service in Minneapolis that Michael's talking about there. We pulled a little bit of the data from the NPR Marist poll. Tom, we haven't found your number yet, but I do want to read a couple of other pieces of data there and then go to a couple calls. Overall, 67% said Trump has mostly increased racial tensions, including 92% of Democrats, 73% of independents, 88% of African Americans, and 63% of whites. 63% say they have either a great deal or a fair amount of confidence in the police, but that's down from 71% from a similar poll in 2014. We're going to have to go to a break again. That clock keeps coming after us. But before we do, I do want to get a couple caller voices in at 800-423-8255. We've got Angela on the line from Cambridge. Angela, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I feel we can't let this moment slip away. We can't let it be like 68 or 80 or all these times when people say to us, oh, it's so much better now than it was in name your year. And I think that the solution is reparations. I think economic equality will do a whole lot to slow down the violence towards people, because economic equity will enable people to hire a lawyer, to publicize what's happened to them, to live wherever
they
want.
Angela, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I have to in order to get another caller voice in. Thank you for putting a concrete policy proposal on the table for us. I appreciate that. I want to get one more call in before we have to go to a break. We've got Anne from Jamaica Plain.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a white woman of two white boys, and I'm haunted by an experience 2 years ago on the soccer field in Arlington, where my son's team, which is 15 Haitian American players, a Latino player, and a white Irish American mixed player, who's my son, were playing, and the opposing team was trying to, like, instigate, I don't know if they did it strategically, but horrid racial abusive language, the N-word repeatedly, dumbass N-word, the ref.
Okay,
and
let's not repeat
thing.
The language. Yeah, so and the ref didn't do a thing. I hear you on that, and we are a public radio station. We do have to be thoughtful of the words that we're putting on air. I'm sorry to have to go to a break after that. We probably should have done that call after the break. But when we come back, let's talk about specific actions of individuals, of individual white people, and of policy. I'm Tiziana Deering. Panelists, please hold on. This is Radio Boston. There's more ahead. Welcome back to Radio Boston's Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are talking about another week of mostly peaceful protests around the country and right here in the Commonwealth on race, policing, brutality. Our guests are Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors, Howard Bryant, author and senior writer for ESPN, and Tom Nichols. He's a professor of national security affairs. We do welcome you to call in at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I do want to acknowledge that we had a caller just before the break who was quoting language that distressed her during a soccer game one of her children played in, but that language may have been really distressing for some of our listeners. And if so, I apologize for that distress. I do want to come back to our panelists now. I'd like us to begin to pivot into personal action, social action, public policy, the next steps that people must begin to take to move forward if this is not to be a repeat of the different eras and moments that all three of you have already mentioned from our own history. Michael Curry, maybe I'll have you start here.
Yeah, so I want to acknowledge the last caller when the phrase that comes to my mind with her call is, this too is America. We have not acknowledged or wanted to come to terms with the fact that there is that kind of racial animus still today that play out in football fields and offices and in academic institutions every day in this country, and it happens often. So this too is our America. In terms of turning to and really starting to focus on solutions, they've already been there, right? The roadmap to this work has been done and been laid for generations by activists, leaders, NAACP, Urban League, Latino organizations, Latinx organizations, Asian organizations. They've been talking about in the criminal justice space, how do we deal with mass incarceration? Right? Read the letter, the new Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander or Elizabeth Hinton's book. These books lay out the foundation of the history of this and talk about solutions. So we know we need more police accountability. We know we need to deal with the protections, the deference we give law enforcement that says, you know what, and I say this as provocative as it is, it's real. You don't have to hang them from a tree and burn them anymore. You do not have to drag them from the truck like you did, like James Byrd in Texas. Just get a badge and become an officer. And that doesn't mean every one of them, but it means that there is no doubt that there are officers who walk around with racial hatred because we see them post on social media. And then they enter those jobs and they get to live it out and they have the protection. They have the protections of our laws that keep them from being held accountable. And if you've been African-American and you've been, or people of color and you've been paying attention, it's not isolated. It's happening across the country. Last but not least, all of the above, body cameras, civilian review, certification for police officers, removing their, taking their badge and their gun, having transparency about around how many violations and use of force complaints they've had against them. We know in this case in Minneapolis, this man had way too many complaints. I think of Training Day with Denzel Washington. He was training them how to be violent in Black neighborhoods.
So, yeah. Michael, I'm going to bring this to Howard and Tom, and I want to note that today the city of Minneapolis negotiated an agreement with the state that would essentially outlaw, I'm not sure that's the technical term, but the chokehold and knee on the neck, as well as hold officers who don't act when they see illegal force being used, hold them accountable. So that is an immediate policy change with a law enforcement department in a city in America. Howard, Tom, are those steps enough? Are they the right first start? And what else needs to be done? Howard, I think you were trying to jump in there.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it's a question of enforcement. I mean, I think that a lot of times I think about this in terms of fear. There's no fear on the part of officers that there's going to be repercussions when they kill. The civil suits come from your taxes. They're not, their pensions aren't affected. Nobody's affected by this. They, when they get suspended, their unions are so strong, they can get jobs. But I love unions, but I'm saying that they're so powerful, they can get reinstated or they go back and they can get a job somewhere else. So there's no real accountability to these police. And I think as much as Michael was talking about the hardcore levels of policy changes and such, I also think we need a cultural change. And for our sport, when you're looking at post 9/11 America has been the building of police as heroes in the pop culture, in sports, and everywhere you go. And because of that, you see a lack of accountability because juries are not willing to convict them because of this sort of hero worship that we've done all over the place. And now I think when you're seeing that violence in the street, it's sort of demystifying. It's absolutely demystifying for me what these folks are actually out there doing to people. But I think there's one other thing, too, that we need to consider.
Howard, I apologize. And I am going to come back to your one other thing. Yeah. But I want, With Tom Nichols teaching in national security, and I hear your point about the glorification of domestic law enforcement since 9/11, probably alongside military might and U.S. military forces as well. So I wanted to give Tom a chance to respond to that, Howard, before you made your second point.
Well, we're I think part of the problem is we've had a collapse of civic virtue that's been going on for decades. And strangely enough, part of it is because military service is no longer universal. So we kind of outsource that to volunteers, and then we lionize them and valorize them. I will admit, for example, this is probably a controversial thing to say, I don't like seeing veteran license plates with medals on them. To me, that's a very Soviet kind of, I studied the Soviet Union. Wearing your medals in public is a very Soviet kind of thing. My dad's best friend won the Silver Star in Germany for doing something like Saving Private Ryan, terrifyingly brave. And I didn't know about it until he was dead. That was a different generation that simply did not valorize military or police service and did not ask for it to be valorized. And I think that, you know, we need to come back to that. But as a more practical matter, I am a great believer in incremental victories building momentum. Michael is absolutely right. I have no idea what it's like to be an African-American man, suffer the kind of indignities, you know, so that I have no advice there. But if this becomes, and I'm speaking now to one of your callers, if this moment becomes about reparations and ending racism, it will be a moment about everything and about nothing. If it becomes about things like ending qualified immunity, which actually has broad bipartisan support, it will be about something. If it becomes about greater accountability, it will be about something. If it becomes a slogan like abolish the police, it's going to run right into a brick wall the way previous efforts at reform have done. So by my nature, I am incremental and cautious. Maybe that's part of the problem of having actually worked in, you know, policy environments where that's how things get done. But I think that those incremental wins can actually build momentum for greater change. And I think that's the door that's been opened right now, where there are all kinds of things you could do and write into law, particularly after November, if the president is gone, that could substantively change the quality of life for millions of people. And if it becomes—
Thanks, Tom. I want to come
everything,
back
then there's a problem.
Thank you for that, Tom. I wanted that direct response. Howard, I asked you to put the pause button on. You did have a second point. Let me come back to you now. Thank you.
Yeah, that second point was simply that I think we also have to make sure that as we spend so much time talking about Black Lives Matter and we talk about effects on the police for Black people, I think we also have to realize that what we're seeing out here as to why this moment is different from some of the other moments we've seen over the past few years is the accumulation of everything else taking place in this country, where you have a lot of people of all races out there in the street right now who feel this is the police out there. If you're watching DC and you're watching Minneapolis and New York, they're not just targeting Black people. They're targeting everybody. And so that's one of the reasons why I think this moment feels very different, and why I think that there's an opportunity to sustain it into policy, because it's one thing for African-Americans, for Black people to want to be free. We're trying to just get to zero. We're trying to get to even with whites. But when you start to take away the freedoms that these young white kids have out there, where they believe that this is theirs and they're getting hit with batons and such, that's not going to just go away. I would like to think that's going to translate as the months get closer to the election.
If I could just chime in just really quickly.
Yes.
And I appreciate Tom and Howard and their views on this stuff. I would probably push back on the reparations piece as a non-starter. I think Tom's grandfather or father would have thought differently about reparations than his grandchildren will. I think we've evolved tremendously as a nation.
That's a great point.
Grandkids of those who were opposed to it, like Evanston, Illinois, included it as a tax on marijuana for African-Americans, descendants of slaves. If we're debating right now in Congress a $3 trillion stimulus package to reposition America, right? Too big to fail, investments into folks getting a check in the mail. If we understood the history of African Americans in this country and how they've been disenfranchised, not allowed to vote, 3/5 of a human being, locked out of wealth, denied jobs. My mother could not go to college. She was a housekeeper. That's a generation ago. If we understood that, we'd have a different conversation about reparations. It wouldn't be a non-starter. And I think for those kids that are marching in the street, it's not. They're actually taking that seriously.
So I want to ask, you know, we had Anne before the break. You talked about her call again after the break, Michael, saying this is America. Part of what she was trying to ask there was no one called out the referee who didn't call out the kids. And one of the things that we've seen in calls, some of which I've gotten to on air and some of which I haven't, as we've had repeated conversations this week, is white callers saying, what do I do? How do I step up? What's the next step for white people to take in this moment? And I've also heard so many of our guests who are African-American this week say, I don't want to have to think that we're doing this again and nothing's going to change. Those two things seem to me that they go together. So what is the call to action to white people who are out protesting in the street right now about the public policy steps white people need to advocate for next?
Go ahead, Tom.
I was thinking about the fact that Howard lives in Northampton because I grew up right down the street in Western Massachusetts. And again, and I'm just going to say it because I think this answer is both, this is both to your point, Tiziana, and to Michael's point about things like reparation and who takes what seriously. If the kids that are out there getting beat up right now, white, black, or otherwise, if they show up to vote, they will have a tremendous impact on the election all across the country. And, you know, maybe I'm just old. Maybe this is from, you know, working on Beacon Hill. In the end, I'm like, yes, these are all important issues, but who shows up to vote? I mean, that's, you know, that's old. That's the old school, you know, Boston question. And I want people to show up to vote. And I'm concerned, again, that whenever a moment like this becomes about so many things that it, you know, and I think Howard had a great point that people say, okay, I showed up, I said things, I tweeted stuff, I put things on, and then they kind of just drift away. I think that if this turns into voting, which to me, Howard, I am going to disagree with you about, you know, voting isn't the most important thing. It's the foundation for everything, because without it, all the activism in the world doesn't, you know, isn't going to change very much. But I think that's the thing I'm most concerned about is can all of this, not just this moment, but everything we've been living through for the past three and a half years be turned into it?
I'm just going to jump in there, Tom, only because we have a little less than 2 minutes left. I want to make sure to hear from also Howard and Michael. So Howard, in about a minute, what's your answer to the question?
My answer to the question is that you stay on target. And I think all the pressure matters and all of the pressures that you put on, you have to keep people involved. But I think that the most important thing that I've seen in all of this, when you're saying what can white people do, well, what you can do is you can stay involved and you can stay, you know, you can stay vigilant on very specific things. And when you talk to Black people and when you look at all of these different things, whether you go back to Tamir Rice, you go to Eric Garner, wherever you go, the anger, and Colin Kaepernick as well, the anger is that we're going to the funeral, that cop doesn't even get arrested without pressure, and then when they do get arrested, they get acquitted. This piece has to change. If this piece doesn't change, then we are right back here at square one, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, and Michael Curry, we've got 30, 45 seconds for you, please.
Yeah, I would say to those who want to be supportive, this is chess, not checkers. The reality is, I don't care if you like Joe Biden, and this is a very partisan statement as an individual. I don't care if you don't like him, if you're offended by him. I know many African Americans are not Joe Biden crazy. If Donald Trump wins another term, there goes the Supreme Court. There go all the fights that we did for the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. There goes police reforms that we put in place. There are elections have consequences. So I say that first. Show up and vote. I agree with Howard. There is absolutely a need to vote. Take the census. Make sure you're counted. Very important. Otherwise, you will pay the price on the next redistricting, and you'll pay the price in terms of resources. And last but not least, be a student of history. If you really want to help, I don't want to talk
10 seconds, Michael.
A police officer governor who doesn't know their history, it makes for an easier conversation.
All right. Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, Tom Nichols, a professor of national security affairs, and Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN. Thanks to all three of you. Thanks to the listeners. That's our show for today. I'm Tiziana Deering. I hope you'll join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.